Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bibliophiles of the world, the handwriting is sadly on the wall. E-books are the wave of the future. We know because Microsoft said so today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, gazelle it.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 30th of April. Good to have you with us. And if you had, by chance, been wondering where Microsoft was in the increasingly relevant e-reader market, well, wonder no more. Today, the software company said it's going to spend $300 million on hardware, Barnes & Noble's Nook reader, to be specific. There's going to be a joint venture focusing on e-books, and in particular, the very lucrative college textbook business. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going today.
Listen to what CNET executive editor David Carnoy has to say about the potential profit from digital textbooks.
It's in the billions of dollars, so I think it's a huge market.
Yep, he said billion with a B. Textbooks could be a nice, profitable niche for Barnes & Noble, but the digital textbook world is a bit of a wild west. It's a wide-open market with lots of competitors.
It is kind of messy.
Bob O'Donnell is an e-reader analyst at IDC. He says the e-textbook race is on, and Apple has a head start. It already offers interactive textbooks on the iPad. O'Donnell says e-textbook sellers are feeling their way in this crowded market.
Because people are still trying to figure out the best options, and they're trying to figure out additional material they can include to try and make money.
Some digital textbooks have cool add-ons like tutoring programs and homework reminders that almost make me wish I were back in school. Kathy Mickey is a digital textbook analyst at Simba.
They facilitate a student's management of homework. It tends to be automatically folded in for particular courses so that kids know what's up.
Mickey says e-textbooks haven't overtaken print textbooks by any means, but over the next decade, the lure of digital will be too hard to resist, and e-textbook sales will explode. After all, what student can resist the prospect of a much lighter backpack? I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We got some economic numbers here this morning. Consumer spending last month was a bit more tepid than the experts had been hoping. But lukewarm as things are here, we are positively humming right along when you compare us with Spain. We learned this morning Spain has dipped into its second recession in 3 years, just the latest sign that Europe's economic problems are still very much front and center. Economist Edward Hugh, an expat Brit, studies the Spanish economy from Barcelona. Mr. Hugh, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So a lingering debt crisis that we've had a couple of years to get used to is one thing. It seems to me a recession in Spain is quite another, no?
Oh, very definitely so, yes. I mean, everybody's concerned about fiscal deficits and adjusting fiscal deficits. But really, Spain's problem, and for the people in the United States to think about it easily, you need to think about somewhere like Florida. Spain's problem is associated with a housing and construction boom, which went fine for several years into the crisis and then collapsed. And it's the economy dealing with the hole that's been left by that collapse that really causes the problem. And the government have difficulty raising the revenue they had before simply because the level of economic activity has collapsed.
Well, put this in context for me. I mean, we are very familiar over here with the Greek debt crisis. Greece, though, is a relatively small economy. How much bigger is Spain, and then how much bigger a problem does that make it for the world?
Well, I would say Spain is about five times bigger than Greece. So it's a much bigger problem.
Yeah.
Spain's the fourth biggest economy in the euro area. It's not as big an economy as Germany, but it's big enough to really be a problem if it goes too far wrong.
Did I read it right this morning that unemployment in Spain is 24%?
You did read it right, unfortunately, yes. And it's still going up.
You know, we had Timothy Geithner on the program on Friday, the Secretary of the Treasury over here, and I asked him about Europe and whether the American economy was strong enough to survive something bad happening in Europe. And he was declarative. He said, we are strong enough. Everything is fine. Do you believe that?
Would that the world was so simple. You know, I mean, obviously the United States economy is in a much stronger position at this present point in time than the European economy. But, I mean, clearly, if Spain has a serious problem and this creates a problem which unwinds the euro area, and that's the risk, you know, then naturally it's going to be noticed in the United States. It won't be good news.
Is, if I could invent the word here, is Spain bailoutable? I mean, it's so much bigger and it's such a more systemic problem.
Well, yes, it's not bailoutable using the model of Ireland, Portugal, or Greece. It's too big for that. It is possible that you could have a partial, in fact, not only possible, I think it's very highly likely in the coming months we will see this kind of partial bailout of Spain from the European Union.
But we went through all of the Sturm und Drang, if you will, of the Greek crisis, and yet it's still a mess.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Even Greece is not resolved, really, because Greece is still inside a program where it's got targets to meet that it may not meet at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But don't imagine you've heard the last word from Greece yet.
Economist Edward Hugh, we got him in Barcelona. Mr. Hugh, thanks very much for your time, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
April stocks went out on a low note. Traders can read the paper just like everybody else. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow's a red-letter day in American theater. The Tony nominations are going to be announced in the morning, and it's entirely possible that Spider-Man, yes, that Spider-Man, the Broadway show that was once the laughingstock of the theater world, could wind up with a couple of nominations. How, you ask, is that possible after all the bad press and accidents and critical shellackings it took? We sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill to find out.
Critics hated Spider-Man when it first came out. The New York Times' Ben Brantley said it was like, quote, watching the Hindenburg burn and crash. Chris Caggiano blogs about musicals and teaches at the Boston Conservatory.
A year ago, if you had told me that we would be looking at the prospect of Spider-Man actually getting a nomination for Best Musical, I'm not exactly sure what I would have said.
Spider-Man has been reworked from its original burn and crash version into something more straightforward that crowds seem to love. Michael Shulman covers theater for The New Yorker. He thinks the show could garner a nomination for technical production.
Certainly what they're doing technically is groundbreaking, but at the same time, you know, can you really reward someone for flying technology that has caused concussions and, you know, herniated discs and whatever else has befallen the people in the show.
But Broadway isn't the end game for Spider-Man, says NYU professor Lawrence Maslon.
I think in this day and age, they wanted to open it on Broadway, get a toehold on Broadway, and then use that as a springboard to do it in Las Vegas, internationally, do it in arenas.
Maslon says it's time to leave Spider-Man alone. Let it spin its ticket-selling web and let its audience just enjoy it. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The Prime Minister of Japan spent a couple of hours with President Obama at the White House today. Oval Office, joint press conferences, the whole smash. So, this question. Can you name the Prime Minister of Japan? Yeah, that's kind of the point. Yoshihiko Noda is the sixth incumbent in that office in the past 5 years, the latest to try to get the economy once known as Japan Inc. back on track. Marketplace's Scott Tong was in Japan not too long ago, asking around to find out how bad is it over there, really.
You may have heard here and elsewhere that Japan is cooked.
Japanese economy has not been growing for the last 20 years.
Its leaders are out of touch.
The more they speak, the longer their nose becomes.
Its birth rates are down. Its men are wimps.
Their preference is not to be like manly men.
One interviewee compared Japan to Portugal from the Club for Over the Hill Empires. But here's the thing. When you go to Japan, it doesn't feel like some boarded up shack of an economy. The restaurants give tip-top service, even though there's no tipping. Kids commute to school themselves. It's so safe. And the only jaywalkers seem to be the foreigners. On Amada's Tokyo shopping street, many elderly told me that for all the talk of the lost decade, quality of life in Japan is good. 72-year-old Takahiro Saito offers up some bread and some memories.
We had many blackouts during the war. Not anymore. Now we have utilities, a good sewer system, nice toilets.
Ah, the Japanese toilet. Think heated seats, multiple spray nozzles, blow-drying and deodorizing functions. How can an economy supposedly this bad be this good?
Westerners have always disbelieved the Japanese growth story.
Tokyo author and journalist Eamon Fingleton argues the Japanese decline is a myth propagated by Americans who don't like the Japanese system. They think Big Brother picks corporate winners. It messes with the free market.
So they look at Japan and see a very regulated economy and say this economy is very inefficient. They're actually wrong.
His evidence? The typical Japanese person, we'll call him Ichiro the plumber, makes $42,000, pretty close to Joe the plumber, and he lives 5 years longer. Japan's currency is strong, and its companies still crank out top equipment, like lenses to make computer chips.
There are only two countries in the world that can make lenses to this level of precision, Japan and Germany. Know-how is very, very important at the top end of manufacturing, and the Japanese have it in spades.
By the measure of GDP per person, Japan's prosperity has not gone down yet. Richard Ku is an economist at Nomura Bank.
As long as GDP per capita is growing, I think people should be happy.
As long as it's growing is the key. Like a lot of rich countries, Japan creeps along. It racks up debt. It gets older. Can it keep up?
At the end of the day, you just have to run faster.
Ku says just as Japan caught up to the U.S. back in the day, now the chaser is now the chased, with Korea and China on its tail.
You have to be able to come up with new products, new designs, new fashion. You need someone who thinks differently from the others.
Innovation. If that's how you sustain an advanced economy, Japan may have some work to do. That's according to Masaru Tamamoto of Cambridge University and the World Policy Institute.
It's really simply put, everything in Japan is borrowed and then refined and made Japanese. But the origin is always an outside origin.
Resident optimist Eamon Fingleton thinks Japan is up to the task. Historically, he says, it has transitioned from textiles to technology to Toyota. And it can handle whatever comes next. Maybe it's clean energy. Maybe it's robots to care for the elderly. Fingleton does concede this, that in the future, Asia's top dog will be China. And yet, as he sees it, the Japanese don't hyperventilate about that.
They see a world that will look rather like it did 500 years ago, led by China. They're used to Chinese culture. They've copied a lot of it. There is a level of comfort with China that people in the West don't quite appreciate.
He thinks Japan's relationship to China is a little like England's to America. Overtaken, but still rich, comfortable, relevant. It's a provocative notion, highly debatable, but a question that a lot of countries are asking. Can a mature economy age gracefully? In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, raising money, it turns out, isn't always about the money.
One of the notions behind Kickstarter is that if you change the question behind funding from will this make money to just do I want this to happen, a lot more things become possible.
Conversation from the corner office at Kickstarter, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Dow Industrial is down 14 points today, a tenth of 1%, finished at 13,213. The NASDAQ retreated 22.7%, closed at 3,046. The S&P 500 gave back 5 points, a 3%, settled at 1,397. The Spanish news helped push some financial stocks lower. Bank of America down more than 1.5%. Citigroup debited 1.3%. Wells Fargo off 1%. Health insurer Humana slumped 8% today after posting a deep drop in profits. The company is one of the biggest providers of Medicare insurance. There were some bright spots today. We told you earlier about the digital textbook deal between Barnes & Noble and Microsoft. Barnes & Noble up 51% on that news. Microsoft up 0.1%. That's how those things go sometimes. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, gazelle it.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues construction spending data for March. How many new wheels hit the road last month? Automakers report sales for April. And I got one word for you, Rosebud. On May 1st, 1941, the film Citizen Kane premiered in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You've heard of pop-up stores, right? Companies setting up storefronts that might only be around for a week or maybe a day or even just a couple hours. It's obviously just a marketing gimmick, a not-so-subtle attempt to gin up consumer excitement over one thing or another. In Oakland, California, though, they've taken it to the next level. A handful of stores have popped up all at the same time with no plans to close. It's called, wait for it, a pop-up hood. And Andrew Stelzer reports it may soon be coming to a hood near you.
Crown Nine Jewelers and Makers has only been open for a few months. It's a small shop in a hidden alleyway in downtown Oakland. But on a recent Friday night, there's steady foot traffic passing through.
These are actually all on cardboard.
Laura Hill, who came from neighboring Berkeley for dinner, just bought two small prints by a local artist. She had no plans to shop here until about 10 minutes ago.
We had never been to this shop. In fact, we just noticed there were a lot of new shops along this road, and so that was a new thing for us. We typically go to the uptown area.
The reason Hill saw a bunch of new shops was no accident. In late November, five stores all simultaneously opened on the same block to create what's being called a pop-up hood. The landlords agreed to give all five businesses free rent for 6 months in order to fill their empty storefronts.
It wasn't a big economic risk, and the payoff made it worthwhile.
Martin Ward is asset manager for PSA Old Oakland Associates, the property owner for all five participating stores.
I was prepared to take that chance because we felt like it was going to take more than one. One retailer, it was a critical mass, I think, was the key component here, and really high-quality retailers.
An art gallery, a bike shop, a jewelry store, a vintage clothing boutique, and a place to buy novelties and crafts. These businesses were handpicked for the project, which so far has been a boon for the neighborhood.
The grand opening of Pop-Up Hood was one of my best days ever in my restaurant.
Alfonso Dominguez's restaurant is just around the corner from the Pop-Up Hood. Dominguez has had two other businesses fail right on the same block, but he refused to give up on this undervalued corner of his native city.
But it's a gorgeous, I mean, look at it. I mean, these buildings are worth gold. From the late 1800s, I mean, architecture that you could never build again.
100-year-old Victorians, tree-lined streets, public transit connecting to the whole San Francisco Bay Area. What's called the Old Oakland neighborhood has a lot going for it. But for some reason, most of the retail space on this block had been sitting vacant for years.
We have the restaurants, we have the bars. The missing experience was just walking around and shopping, window shopping.
So Dominguez, along with a business partner, pitched the pop-up hood idea to the city of Oakland. The city contributed $30,000 to the project for renovations and also donated advertising space on billboards and bus shelters.
The hardest part when you're opening a new business is letting people know that you're here.
Carrie Johnson is co-owner of Marion and Rose's Workshop, one of the stores in the pop-up hood. Her clothing and accessories shop even turned a profit in January and February, typically two of the slowest months for retail.
The amount of effort that we would have individually put in alone, it would have taken us probably close to 7 to 10 years to get to this point, you know, that we're at already with the amount of visibility that we have.
Johnson's 6 months free rent runs out on May 1st, but she plans to sign a long-term lease. It looks like most of the stores will become permanent. Now Chicago, Detroit, and other cities have contacted Oakland, asking how they might organize a pop-up hood of their own. In Oakland, California, I'm Andrew Stelzer for Marketplace.
Used to be that if you had an idea, something you wanted to make or a project you wanted to get done, you had to go see people, people with money, venture capitalists or angel investors. Now, you just go online. Today, for the latest installment of our series, Conversations from the Corner Office, we go to a converted three-story walk-up down on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, the offices of Kickstarter, the new thing in crowdsourced funding. You pitch your idea, they put it on their website, and if all goes well, the internet chips in to get you the money you need. Sounds kind of simple, so the first thing I asked co-founder Yancey Strickler was, even though they're still in that startup mindset, working real hard, is what Kickstarter does every day hard work?
It doesn't feel like work very often, and there are 37 people who work at Kickstarter right now. It's a great environment. It really does not feel like work very often.
As you grow, how confident are you that you can maintain that feeling you have here now of being 37 people in a place in Lower Manhattan doing this thing that you're all really passionate about?
It's definitely going to be a challenge. You know, we're not interested in having a really huge team. We'd like to stay as small as we can. If a project is successfully funded, we charge 5% of what they raise as our fee. And based on that, we're able to have 37 employees. We're able to grow. People have health insurance, you know, our offices are pretty nice, you know.
But that's no small thing,
right? It is no small thing. You know, there's no advertising on Kickstarter. There's no corporate matching of projects. There are none of those kinds of things. And certainly there are many opportunities to do things like that. But to us, they are obviously wrong because they don't fit with what our notion of what Kickstarter is.
You started with an emphasis on filmmakers and artists and projects along those lines. You now have entrepreneurs and people with actual business propositions and products. I mean, the most well-known one probably recently is this Pebble Smart watch. It's got $6 million worth of Kickstarter funding. It syncs with your phone and does all this kind of stuff. Are you guys now venturing into the world of venture capital? Is that what's happening?
No, not at all. I mean, the line between a project and a business can be a fuzzy one. So a good example would be the product design kind of things. Mm-hmm. When those were first coming to us, and the real first one of those is a project called the Glyph, which is a tripod for an iPhone 4. And our concerns were just this doesn't exactly feel like Kickstarter. It's making, you know, an iPhone accessory. Does that really feel right?
Right.
But as we thought about it more and more, you know, I think the notion hit us that creativity can be applied in a number of different ways. And so if you look around the site, you'll see a huge variety of things that cover, you know, almost anything imaginable. But there's some kernel, there's some desire to create, to make that is constant in all of them.
Do you remember the first project Kickstarter ever got?
Yeah, the first project ever was launched by Perry, actually.
One of the co-founders.
One of the co-founders, our CEO. I actually can't say the name of it on the air. It was a T-shirt that on it had a stencil that said, Grace Jones does not give a f-. We can bleep that out, I guess. The project was unsuccessful, but in truth...
Oh, it didn't fund, really?
It didn't fund, but
great.
The first one to actually be funded was called Drawing for Dollars, and it was 6 days into Kickstarter successful, and it raised $35 from three people.
Do you remember the first $1 million project?
The first $1 million project was just about 10 weeks ago by a guy named Casey from Seattle, and it's an iPhone dock.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I saw this one.
Yeah. So it raised $1 million.
Yeah.
He was trying to raise $75,000. He ended up raising about $1.5 million. But the really crazy thing was the day his project crossed $1 million, another project did it 4 hours later, and that project had launched the day before.
Dude, really? Critical mass, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah, it was a really, really crazy day.
I imagine you have already been approached by larger companies, by investors, by people who want a piece of you. Obviously, you've said no, but will there come a point when you say, yeah, now's the time for us to get out of this?
And no, there's no interest in that whatsoever.
Thoughts of an IPO, of taking it public?
No, it's not like that. I mean, we're not thinking about those kinds of things.
We are, what, a mile or something from Wall Street, plus or minus, from the cutthroat, rip-your-eyeballs-out heart of American capitalism. How do you guys fit into that equation? Because you wouldn't think of it as being connected, but you are.
You know, I think that there's something to having a diversity of funding options in the world. The past 100 years have been one that have been dominated by, you know, corporations and investment. But the truth is that that investment model leaves a lot of things out. One of the notions behind Kickstarter is that if you change the question behind funding from will this make money to just do I want this to happen, a lot more things become possible. There's a lot about Kickstarter that is very similar to patronage, and it is a model that's a meshing of patronage and commerce. You know, old forms of patronage were about, you know, the elite being able to just incentivize people to create the art that they wanted, and now you have anyone can be a patron of the arts, anyone in the world.
Yancey Strickler, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
There's more on our website, conversations from other corner offices, and an audio tour of Kickstarter memorabilia, Yancey walking me through some of the projects funded through the site and what they got in return. Marketplace.org is the website.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, this being a Monday, we were greeted with the customary box office figures for new movies this morning, and we learned that Battleship, the latest blockbuster from Universal, has taken in $170 million so far, which is kind of funny because it doesn't open here for another 2.5 weeks. Forbes points out that the film, which has been roundly panned by critics, is being opened overseas just to get some of its investment back in advance of perhaps taking a drubbing here in the States. Disney apparently did the same thing with Avengers over the weekend, opened in 13 countries overseas, made $178 million, although that one I am going to go see. Come on, Captain America and Thor together? How can you go wrong? All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow lost 14 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ retreated 22.7 tenths of 1%. The S&P 500 down 5 points. 0.3%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Come on, Captain America, Thor. It's going to be great. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.